Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, and we're going to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, November 4th, 2021. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon, Melody, and happy National Candy Day. It's also National Men Make Dinner Day. So I guess you know what I'm going to be doing after today's program.
Yeah, going out and buying a candy bar.
No, I'm going to make two nice salads.
Good, good. Awesome. Well, you know, it was a strange day in the markets today. I mean, gold opened up, silver opened up, and it's just like it just stayed there. It didn't move. Gold right now is up $24. Did touch 1800 before it came back to 1794, and that's still up $24. Silver was up 25 cents to $23.85. Platinum was down 4 to 1033. Palladium was down 3 at 2083. It's pressure on the dollar down 0.46 at 94.32. Crude oil was down 1.81 at 79.05. And the paper markets today, the Dow was down 33 points at 36,124. The S&P was up 19 at 4,680. NASDAQ was up 128 at 15,940. And, let's go see what did Asia do? Asia was strong all across the board. Europe was good. The world is all happy. I guess there was a couple central banks that came out last night, decided to keep their rates the same and so forth. So I guess that all had a positive effect on some of these world stock markets. And the U.S. 10-year yield today was 1.52%, 1.52%. And, you know, some of the things, Dave, that we're going to talk about, we have, you know, we mentioned this yesterday about the bond tapering is going to begin. It's a first step in pulling back some of the massive amounts of funds that they've been providing the markets and the economy. And they're supposed to start later this month. You know, and again, it's like, okay, $15 billion out of 120, you know, it's peanuts. Absolutely peanuts. I don't know why they're making such a big deal out of it. And because, you know, they'll come right back with it if the markets don't hold up, and the markets know this. And so, you know, I don't know. What say you, Dave?
Well, I think I agree with you. I mean, in Powell's own words, you know, we'll continue to do what's necessary you know, to achieve their goals, which, you know, we know is roughly stable inflation, we'll say, if not 2%, plus full or maximum, you know, employment, whatever the heck that is. So they will indeed. And I, you know, while there's never any guarantee, and it will be interesting and I think somewhat dependent on Biden's decision in terms of who's the next Fed chair. Will it be Powell, which will mean policy as usual, or will it be Boehner, which may still be policy as usual, but maybe a little tweaking in words, in Fed speak. You know, that not a whole lot is going to change in any event, I suspect. The only encouraging possibility, I think, is if someone like Brainard gets Quarles' vice chair position or responsibilities for oversight, that perhaps Brainerd will do a little better job of that than Quarles has. But as a whole, it's more of the same, and it's of the banks, by the banks, and for the banks. I mean, after all, you've got the New York Fed, which is basically the main branch of the Fed, and it's owned by the other bank, the other Fed branches. it's an inherent
insanity
conflict of interest. So I don't see much changing. And I mean, certainly, even if they do this $15 billion a month, $10 billion reduction in treasury purchases and $5 billion in mortgage-backed securities, it's $15 billion a month times 8 months. That's where they're getting this July figure, although it's not exactly like that. It's going to be, I think, $10 billion reduction in December, they say anyway. But as Powell said, we don't think it's time to raise interest rates yet. There's still more ground to cover before the Fed reaches its economic goals. So let the labor market heal further, Melody. Excuse me.
It's just insanity. You know, it just is really... You know, they go back and forth. It really is a show that has really played out over such a long period of time. It just seems it's the same old thing day in and day out. And the same, you know, and as long as the stock market is priced, everybody's happy. And it doesn't matter how it affects each and every, all the people out there that are having difficulties in their everyday lives. And kudos. I mean, stock market is important for those who have retirement accounts and their pensions and everything like that. That's what it's all based on. So it's very important to those folks, to keep it higher and so forth. But, you know, it's such a rigged game. You know, they had a short segment on CNBC this morning about, you know, the options, all the record amount of people retail buying options and the impact and how it distorts the markets and pushes the prices higher and, you know, because they're all hedging. And it's just like, you know.
Well, there's where a little knowledge can be extremely dangerous.
Options are very dangerous.
Stuff like that and other derivatives. I mean, but like you said, Melody, it remains the same. And it remains the same because it's the same people. It's not the same individuals per se, but it's the revolving door. You know, work for Citibank, work for Barclays, work for JP Morgan Chase, then spend 4 years in administration, be it Democratic or Republican. And then, let's go back. And in many cases, you have individuals that have come from those mega banks that are in positions that supposedly regulate those mega banks. And after their term, when they're tired of making $175,000 a year, well, let's go back to my mega bank where I can make, you know, twice, five times, 10 times more with my stock options. The system is inherently corrupt, ladies and gentlemen. And until that is changed, which is to say until we, the people, somehow can muster the strategy, the tactics, whatever they are, to change, to get our elected people to change them or to run them out of office, it just ain't going to change. Get used to it. Sorry. Don't kill the messenger.
But the thing of it is, it will change when I think the system just becomes... I mean, anytime anything is corrupt, it collapses.
Well, there you go.
I mean, and that's just a fact. Because there's always something that comes along that destroys their ability, and it gets exposed. So eventually it does. And of course, you know, then we relate it to our money, our policy, our fiat currency and everything else. The total amount of debt that this country carries, it does make a difference. It will make a difference. We just don't know how long that they can carry all of this out. But we're seeing more and more. Dave, there was just a couple of nitrogen shortage. Have you heard anybody talk about a nitrogen shortage?
My God, what'll happen to my grass?
Yeah, to force U.S. farmers to scale back on fertilizer. What does that mean if farmers have to cut back on fertilizer?
Well, I'll tell you what
products.
It'll mean.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it'll mean here, Melody. It'll mean less stinky days.
No, it's going to mean less crops, more higher and higher pricing.
Yeah.
Food prices are going to rise even more. You know, if you have to scale back the fertilizer application, that means lower corn yields. That'll push the corn prices higher. Feeder corn to your cattle, that means beef prices are going to rise. Fertilizer is scarce right now because of high costs for natural gas. That's a key raw material. Have halted some production in Europe. Other countries like China and Russia, they're imposing restrictions on exports to try and safeguard their local supplies. The U.S. is a major importer of farm nutrients, importing 20% of its urea and 40% of ammonium nitrate from Russia alone. So they're cutting back because they don't want to get, you know, they don't want to go short. So where are we going to get our stuff? Prices for potash and urea, a form of nitrogen fertilizer, that has more than doubled this year. Doubled. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like milk. You got milk prices. The average price of a gallon of whole milk in the USA has risen 4% over the past year and 1.4% since the beginning of 2021. It's still rising. When you look at meat prices, boneless chuck roast, that surged 28% in last year. Well, you know what gasoline has done. So again, your food prices are rising. There was another article I saw something of, Dave, where other than gold rising, yeah, the meat sticker shock. I mean, it's everywhere, Dave. And I don't see it just turning around because the Fed is going to start pulling back on its spending. So I don't know how all of that feeds into their program, to their transitory inflation, as they call it. So, and it doesn't matter if it's transitory, even if it is, what happens? So if it's 6 months, so they define transitory as 6 months. Did they ever define transitory as a length of time, Dave?
Not specifically. Powell addressed it yesterday. Let me talk about that more in the third segment today, but he talked about it in terms of months. Now, not 6 months, not 9 months, not 12 months, but months. So possibly for the first time, he's honed in on sort of a broader, well, a less, we'll say a less broad definition. But still, we don't know exactly where they're coming from with this transitory thing.
But, you know, well, months of inflation can have people default in their homes. It can have major impacts.
Even if it eventually comes down. It will never go down all the way, or almost never.
It's like taxes.
Yeah. Yes. Well.
Mm-hmm. But that's like taxes. What goes up never comes down in our in the world of the U.S. What goes up stays up.
So yeah, I don't know where exactly this transitory period ends and something more lasting begins. But as we know, with the fiat currency, the dollar, there's a loss in purchasing power.
Absolutely.
Every day.
Absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see what the jobs report is tomorrow.
Indeed.
But so, you know, the big question with the Fed, you know, tapering, you know, everybody's, I don't think personally, I think it was good to see gold respond to the Fed. Not that they have come out and made the official announcement, because we did see gold and silver rise to this. But regardless of whether they do, whether they don't, gold prices are still going to rise and silver prices are still going to rise. I mean, the fundamentals of, and gold does just as well in a rate increase, interest rate increase environment as the opposite. So, but there's a lot out there looking about our national debt. It's got to be dealt with. We have the debt ceiling debacle coming up again in December. And this Gary Wagner, editor of a gold forecast, you know, he talks what we talk about. At some point, when you just print money to get a country out of a recession, it's not good. He thinks at some point that's going to come and bite them in the tail, so to speak. And, of course, that's going to move gold and silver higher. I mean, we know this. I'm not so sure the markets are really digesting the outcomes of the FOMC meeting. You know, they knew what he was going to do and with plenty of advance warning. But we did see gold and silver move higher on that news, and we saw it do very well, Dave.
Yeah, we did. I mean, jumped up $15. Gold did. Silver moved up 50 cents. That was yesterday. Today, as you mentioned, I mean, it hit $1,800. Gold did this morning before settling down some. And silver increased to $24.11, I think, was its high today before some investors began to take profits. So, and that was after the Bank of England decided to maintain its monetary status quo.
Yeah. So that was a good thing. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk a little bit about the U.S. trade deficit hitting a record high. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, Melody in the office, the rest of the program taking care of important client orders. You can reach her at 1-800-375-4188, 800-375-4188. Now, right before the break, we were talking about, speculating of sorts, how this bond purchase tapering of the Fed would affect gold and silver prices, and talking about the initial reaction being very positive, both yesterday afternoon and today. And that's just news of the tapering. Now, assuming that not all of it will be priced in when it eventually occurs, particularly as it's ongoing, I mean, think of what will happen over the upcoming 8 to 12 months. I mean, just other things being equal, as the Fed winds down $120 billion in monthly bond purchases, plus as the national debt jumps to the next level after Congress eventually passes some infrastructure and social engineering packages, and inflation is still going up because of ongoing supply constraints and this pent-up consumer demand, and GDP being suppressed as a result of the labor market issues. I mean, make no mistake about it, too. I mean, despite all the growing dysfunction on Capitol Hill, and it's disgusting and dismaying, I think Democrats are going to find a way to pass those bills before next year's midterm election campaign season gets underway. So I think it all spells really good news for gold and silver, especially with all the other fundamentals in place. It's Thursday, so it means another Department of Labor jobs, jobless claims report. The unemployment picture further improved again last week, with initial filings for unemployment insurance falling to another pandemic-era low. First time jobless claims dropped to 269,000 for the week ending October 30th. That's down 14,000 from the previous week, and a little better than economists' estimates of 275,000. Now, the decline in filing comes amid a rollback in special programs initiated over the past year and a half, with the total of those receiving benefits under all programs dropping another 158,000 to 2.7 million. Now, a year ago, the average was 791,000, and it was 225,000 in March, just before the pandemic declaration sent more than 20 million Americans to the unemployment line. Continuing claims, which run a week behind the headline number, declined 134,000 to just over 2.1 million. All of the jobless totals now are the lowest since March of last year. Now, economist Ian Shepherdson of Pantheon Macroeconomics says the fifth straight weekly drop in jobless claims is consistent with all the other evidence pointing to labor market tightness. He added, with demand reviving, the bar for layoffs is high and rising. Claims appear to be on course to reach the pre-COVID level early next year. Well, again, as Melody alluded to, the claims report comes a day before the Labor Department's closely watched non-farm payrolls count, which is expected to show growth of around 450,000 for October. So we will see what's going on. You know, in other economic news, productivity growth in the U.S. was worse than even the expected decline of 3.2%. It fell 5%, in fact, for the biggest quarterly drop since the second quarter of 1981. That's according to Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics. At the same time, unit labor costs soared 8.3%. And that's a combination of the productivity decline plus a 2.9% increase in hourly compensation. Shepherdson said of that news, the biggest drop in productivity since 1981 is a consequence of Delta's hit to GDP growth, and it tells us nothing about the underlying trend. Although he added, we remain optimistic that productivity growth will average 2+% over the next couple of years at least, as firms use some of their abundant resources to start rebuilding their capital stock. Now, the U.S. trade deficit hit an all-time high in September, $80.9 billion, as American exports fell sharply, while imports, even with supply chain problems at American ports, continue to climb, surprisingly. The September deficit topped the previous record of $73 billion set in June. Of course, the deficit is the gap between what the U.S. exports to the rest of the world and the imports it purchases. In September, exports plunged 3% to $207.6 billion. Imports rose, on the other hand, 0.6% to $288.5 billion. Part of the weakness, anyway, reflected almost a 16% drop in petroleum exports related to the drilling rig and refinery shutdowns during Hurricane Ida in the Gulf of Mexico. Economists expect that decline to reverse in the coming months with petroleum production coming back online more steadily. The politically sensitive goods deficit with China also shot up 15% to $36.5 billion. Now, the overall trade deficit through September hit almost $639 billion. That's a 33% increase over the same period last year. And again, it reflects the surge in U.S. demand for imports compared to last year when many parts of the economy were just shut down because of the pandemic. In September, the deficit in goods rose to $98.2 billion, up a big 10% from August. And the surplus in services rose to $17.2 billion, a 10% increase. And that's still well below the level seen before the pandemic hit. Well, again, they're saying as COVID cases further diminish and the supply chain eventually becomes untangled, I'm not so sure that's going to happen as soon as they think. We'll talk more about that shortly. The U.S. trade deficit should start to improve in the coming months, although the improvement may be modest. Again, according or more familiar with these things than am I. Now, at the end of the last segment, we just talked about the U.S. Trade deficit. Well, here's one picture that defines why. Log jams of U.S. imports stacked on ships off the coast of Los Angeles isn't just getting longer. It's getting wider, too. Would not want to be a leisure boat owner these days in those waters. Of the 77 container vessels waiting as of Tuesday for berth space at the ports of L.A. and Long Beach, 23 had room to carry more than 10,000 containers that are measured in 20-foot equivalent units called TEUs. That share, which is equivalent to 30% of the cubed vessels exceeding 10,000 TEUs, is up from 23% at the end of August when 10 of the 43 anchored ships then topped that threshold. And that's put the average capacity of the waylaid ships close to 6,900
TEUs. That's about 1,000 more than the average just 2 months ago. So it's not just the number of ships that matters in assessing the severity of this snarl. It's the amount of boxes they're carrying as well. With bigger payloads coming into the ports, efforts to move cargo inland on the trucks and on trucks and trains, you're going to have to speed up to make any noticeable dent in the backlog in the near term. The average wait for ships bound for LA exceeded 14 days this week, roughly the amount of time it takes the fastest carriers to cross the entire Pacific. And now we're learning that cargo thefts along the West Coast have spiked. Scott Cornell, who's a crime and theft specialist at Travelers, noted the more that supply chain in general is backed up, the more cargo you're going to have sitting, and that creates a bigger opportunity for theft. Thieves, in fact, made off with more than $5 million worth of goods as a result of the so-called supply chain theft in California during just the third quarter. And that's a surge of almost 50% from a year ago, according to CargoNet. In other parts of the country, CargoNet has seen a year-over-year drop in supply chain theft, but it said it expects to see crimes continue to surge in California and other hard-hit states like Texas and Florida. They're particularly concerned about targeting of computer electronics equipment shipping from California, as well as a breakout of full truckload cargo thefts spreading across the entire eastern U.S. As of this morning, there were 102 container ships waiting to enter the two ports, according to Marine Exchange of Southern California. But as truckers rush to move the pileup, they provide ample opportunity for thieves. Railroad operator Union Pacific also said this week that they've seen a spike in cargo container break-ins, especially as the containers were being hauled by train near downtown L.A. It seems like the crews at the port simply can't increase their work, as President Biden has called for, if they have nowhere to offload the containers. Port officials have told shippers that they'll now be slapped with charges of $100 per day for each truck-bound container that's left for 9 days or more. L.A. city officials, meanwhile, are working to identify vacant lots across the city where some of the containers could be stored temporarily. Now there's another problem that we can hope is transitory. I don't know if you saw this. I don't know. This is falls under the category of be careful what you ask for, especially when you're asking too much. I mean, we've been reading more about, you know, this is workers' times, unions' times with the labor shortage and all these job openings. But John Deere, company says the new contract it provided to striking union employees, 10,000 workers, I believe, is the company's best and final offer, and that they're not returning to the bargaining table. Be interesting to see if those are actually its last words here. But meanwhile, the world's largest maker of farm equipment said that it remains in contact with the United Auto Workers Union that represents its workers, but that it has nothing else to bargain about. Those comments come a day after workers voted down a second tentative agreement, extending the strike by those 10,000 workers into its third week. Mark Housey, Chief Administrative Officer for Deere, said the agreement that we provided is frankly our best and final offer. In order for us to be competitive, we have gone as far as we're going to go. The rejected deal offered larger wage increases, no new tiers to retirement benefits, and a signing bonus of $8,500, I believe, to existing employees. The wage increase, which I believe was 10%, affecting 14 of Deere's facilities, was larger than nearly a dozen other collective bargaining agreements the UAW has negotiated the last couple of years. The company's existing two-tier compensation system, where workers hired since 1997 received less generous benefits than those who started working there before that, has been a sticking point for many employees, but apparently will not or would not have been affected by the tentative agreement. We're still on strike, UAW spokesperson Brian Rothenberg said, adding that the parties are still discussing next steps, although it sounds like the Deere company would beg to differ. Now, again, while the current labor market has strengthened workers' leverage and weakened threats of permanently replacing those on strikes, employees have the most power in sectors where strikes can seriously disrupt or even halt production. In the case of Deere, a pause in operations could have a substantive effect on the harvest, actually, and ripple through to the food sector. Deere has been enjoying record profits with projections for its full-year earnings this year as much as $5.9 billion. The Illinois-based company said it would move into a new phase of its customers' of its customer service continuance plan. House, though, wouldn't give details other than to say the company's focused on meeting customer demand, especially for its parts business. You see a lot of John Deere tractors out there in the country, ladies and gentlemen. The parts business is real important this time of year because farmers are harvesting and need their equipment running at full capacity. Deere's keeping its businesses going right now by staffing facilities with salaried employees, although I'm sure it's been a number of years since those who worked on the floor are fresh with know-how. So we'll see. The stakes are high. So we'll keep you abreast of what's going on. Now, last year, before we get into another break, I saw this. This is interesting. Ford Motor Company will require its U.S. salaried employees to be vaccinated by December 8th or possibly face unpaid leave. That's about 32,000 who'd be affected by this mandate. Ford did say it would consider religious and medical exemptions for employees who can't get the vaccines. Otherwise, employees who refuse to get vaccinated and don't have approved medical or religious accommodation may be put on unpaid leave for up to 30 days. It's not clear what happens after that period. What else can I say about that? Well, I'm not going to say anything more about that. It's a break time. Hope you're going to stick around. Be gone for a couple of minutes. Please come back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Call us again at 1-800-375-4188 or look us up online at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. It's where you can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Just look for the mailbox on the left-hand side of the homepage. This week's blog will be in your email inboxes sometime tomorrow. Now, Melody asked this question in the first segment today. What does transitory mean anyway? This obscure word until this spring. I mean, the word officially reached buzzword status, I guess, sometime this summer when it exited the realm of financial policy wonks and seeped into the outside world where everyday people are talking about inflation. Even so, no one really knew exactly what it meant in the context of inflation because the Federal Reserve, which brought it up, has never really defined it. But yesterday afternoon, Fed Chair Jerome Powell went a little further than he has before in explaining how he at least interprets the term. He said at his Fed press conference after the conclusion of the Federal Open Market Committee policy making meeting, quote, transitory is a word that people have had different understandings of. For some, it carries a sense of short-lived and that there's a real-time component measured in months. Sorry if you're looking for anything more clarifying than that. It's not coming, at least right now. Powell did go on to say that for the Fed, it's not so much a measurement of time, but rather a question of whether the current trend of rising prices will lead to permanently or persistently high inflation. In other words, I guess, if inflation is transitory, then there may be a cyclical storm on the surface, using Powell's words, but it won't leave behind structural pressures on the economy. Now, many have taken sides in the argument over whether inflation is transitory, as the Fed and Powell have said it is, or with or without a common understanding of what that means. The Fed's own view on it informs if and when it will take extraordinary measures in the economy, like raising interest rates from these emergency zero bottom levels. The bottom line, providing more of a window into how Powell views the concept, I mean, helps his credibility a little. As we'll talk about in just a moment, credibility with the Fed is a big deal. They could use some bump there. What's more, the markets seem to be buying it so far, stock markets in particular. We'll see how the markets react later this month when the Fed actually begins paring back its treasury bond and mortgage-backed security purchases. Again, it's buying $80 billion a month in treasury bonds and $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities. It's going to reduce those to $70 billion and $35 billion, respectively, in the next week or two, probably. The Fed will then cut purchases further in December, it says, to $60 billion in treasuries and $30 billion in mortgage securities. And on and on and on, presumably, until it's, well, possibly down to zero again. I don't know if it will ever get there, but it says it'll be phased out by next July. We will see, ladies and gentlemen. How many times did we hear the jobs aren't coming back in the wake of the Great Recession? I mean, coal miners, truck drivers, bank tellers, factory workers. We heard that line all the time. after the housing and banking collapses over a decade ago, somehow people got it in their mind that the big reason why the government's headline unemployment rate was shooting up to 10% was that not enough blue-collar industrial service workers had learned how to code. Anyway, the jobs eventually did come back, mostly. I mean, the people who believed that elevated unemployment was the result of some structural shift were essentially proven wrong. Turns out we just needed to grow the economy. Now, by the beginning of 2020, before the pandemic, the U3 reported unemployment rate had fallen to below 4%. 6, I believe, at the time was over 8, including discouraged workers. Today, we're having a similar discussion. It's like a funhouse mirror version of it. This time, it's not that the jobs aren't coming back. It's that the workers aren't coming back and that the economy supply side has been probably permanently altered. Here's one story from just a month ago about how coal mines are having trouble finding workers in some parts of the country. Miners, as we know, have left the industry and don't appear to be coming back. Aaron Higginson, of Customs Staffing Services, which recruits miners in the Illinois Basin, said, "They used to walk into our office by the hundreds, even more. Now we're holding job fairs all over the place to fill just a few vacancies." Well, Higginson's trying to fill about 300 vacancies right now, three times as many as just a year ago, but attracting miners has become a tough sell. Experienced miners have taken their skills to car manufacturers, construction sites, and other fields where they enjoy less demanding work schedules as well as safer job conditions. Even though mines are boosting wages to try to attract them back, so are other industries. And workers are showing more interest these days in careers that offer a better work-life balance. As Joe Wiesenthal, Bloomberg News, said, it's incredible to read stuff like this in 2021, having remembered all the discourse from 2009 to 2020. But he says the point isn't the struggles of the coal mine recruiters per se. It's the broader school of thought that says the huge shock we saw starting last year has fundamentally altered the trajectory of our economy, with ramifications for labor, inflation, monetary policy, fiscal policy, politics, and portfolios alike. We have market strategist Matt King of Too Big to Fail Citigroup says that the economy has been given such a big whack by the virus and then the huge fiscal and monetary stimulus, it simply can't find equilibrium. And that the various supply chain pressures we're seeing will persist a lot longer than anyone expects or hopes. King sees fragility, instability, and a series of booms and busts that monetary policy can't fix with moderate tweaks to interest rates and inability to regain balance. So, in light of all this, it was interesting hearing yesterday's Powell news conference where his message was basically, workers are coming back, or workers will come back. Yes, we have a lot of disruptions right now, but we're still in a pandemic, right? The virus is still here, like it or not. There are still would-be workers concerned about getting sick. That's real. There are still people who might otherwise be at a job site were it not for their childcare responsibilities. And so Powell, anyway, says he's committed to seeing past this elevated inflation, perhaps even for several more months, in order to stick to prior commitments to wait until the labor market is fully healed. I point out that what fully healed or maximum employment technically looks like, again, is still vaguely defined. After every major shock, there's the temptation to say we're in a big new era. These days, lots of people are talking about it, the new normal. Higher inflation due to fewer workers, a change in consumption patterns, and a perhaps permanent shift in the U.S.-China relationship, the Great Resignation.
I mean, crises like these are a time for big thoughts about what this new era will look like. Writers and economists, particularly politicians, all like to make big calls. But Wiesenthal says, by sticking to the pursuit of a fully healed labor market, right now anyway, Powell's rejecting the transformation temptation. Now, we started today's show talking about the Fed. We talked about the Fed in the middle of the show. We just talked about the Fed a few minutes ago. Why don't we just end the show on the same note? In early April this year, Axios ran this headline, "Poll Indicates Low Trust, Poor Public Perception of the Fed." Axios had commissioned an Ipsos poll that found that 53% of Americans don't trust the Federal Reserve. An earlier Axios Ipsos poll released in late February had found that a stunning 60% of Americans didn't trust the Fed. Not sure what happened in the intervening 6 weeks that changed the mind of those 7%. Regardless, both of those polls were taken before the recent trading scandal that's further damaged the Fed's credibility. Those poll numbers likely explain why Jerome Powell uses every press conference he conducts as an opportunity to state that the Fed's priority is to work for the American people. Thank you, Jay. Unfortunately, as our friends Pam and Russ Martins at Wall Street on Parade say, the facts keep getting in the way of that statement. Powell held another presser yesterday and did more harm to the Fed's credibility, they believe, by making statements that simply don't correlate to the facts on the ground. They point out this question from Politico's Victoria Guida, who asked, she said, the Fed recently announced that there's going to be a new conflict of interest rules for investments by Fed officials, and this follows, obviously, the resignation of two regional Fed presidents. And I'm just wondering, this is to Powell, do you think that there's more you'll need to do to rebuild the credibility of the Fed, such as requiring officials to put their assets in blind trusts? And also, if you could speak as to whether you have any concerns that any rules or laws were broken by Fed officials. Well, Powell, in his statement, in his response to Ms. Gui, just said this. Let me just say that the ethics systems we had in place for decades served us well. And then that was no longer the case. And so we had no moment of denial about that. As a group, we stepped in and we took actions that we took. And within one FOMC cycle, we announced a new set of rules to try to put us back where we need to be, which is we need to have the complete trust of the American people, that we're working in their interest all the time. Absolutely critical to our work, he continued, as it is for any government agency. I feel like this called that into question, so we reacted. I would characterize it strongly and forcefully. If there were other things that we could do that were reasonable, we would certainly do them. So you asked about blind trusts. Well, the overall authority for ethics around these issues in the federal government is the Office of Government Ethics. And they have a long-held position which is not favorable to blind trust. They do not encourage them. They don't think they're effective. They think they're cumbersome. And they think there are better ways to get at the things that need to be done, and those are the things that we're actually doing. So I don't know that there are any blind trusts for that reason, because they're the regulator. They say this on their website, if you look. In terms of laws broken, I asked the inspector general to look to see whether there were rules broken and whether there were laws broken. And I won't speculate on that. But that's with the inspector general now, and of course, out of my hands, unquote. The fact that 53 to 60% of Americans didn't trust the Fed between February and April this year, before again, they became aware that Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan had been allowed to trade like a hedge fund kingpin in S&P 500 futures, means that the Fed had already failed in its mission prior to the trading scandal. And then Powell's statement that the ethics system we had in place for decades served us well seems to be a complete fabrication of real-world facts. Mainstream media has reported since at least 2012 on the aggressive stock trading of prior
Dallas Fed President Richard Fisher. In 2012, for example, CNN reported that Fisher holds common stock in at least 43 companies, including more than 500,000 in Google. Well, Google was and is a big tech company that responds well to a low interest rate environment, something that the Fed has been artificially achieving since the financial crash of 2008. In fact, it's the lack of meaningful ethics at the Fed that has led the majority of Americans to conclude that the Fed is a good old boys club that's controlled by the interests of Wall Street's too big to fail banks. That lack of ethics, though, extends far beyond the current trading scandal. I mean, consider this from the highly respected public interest writer Jesse Eisinger about the breaking news that prior Fed chair and now Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen had barely stepped down from her post as Fed chair before she started raking in millions, multi-millions, from the very mega banks that the Fed regulates and that she oversaw. Eisinger wrote, "This is corruption, but it isn't called that because it's so quotidian. Government service is less about service and has become a deferred compensation plan." That's an excellent observation. And the Fed's ethic rules have also prevented a hornet's nest. It has not prevented a hornet's nest of conflicts of interest at the New York Fed, but that is a story for another time. I'm out of time. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow with the Reverend Butch Paul. Thanks, as always, to our sterling engineer, Todd. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye. I have a plan.